from deep inside your radio.
Yes, it's Beepless. Ladies and gentlemen, from the French Quarter of New Orleans, Louisiana, live, as you know, every edition of this broadcast is a very, very special edition, much like network television. But this is a very special, very, very, very special edition of the show. The program, as I said, is originating in New Orleans, Louisiana, and it just occurred to me that there are conversations every night over dinner, at parties, and on the street, where people are discussing in great detail and with great information what's going on in this city. And nobody outside New Orleans is privy to that. Until now, because I've invited three friends, acquaintances, passionate, informed people from various areas of the city to come in today and talk about New Orleans. And there will also be some regular features on the program. Don't panic. But it's an opportunity for you guys to get in, you around the country and around the world, to get in on what's really going on here, as opposed to what Anderson Cooper is emoting about from time to time. And hey, George Bush is coming down too, speaking of emoting. Anyway, our guests in Studio B. A. Interesting. So I must be in B. We'll have a meeting about that. Chris Rose, columnist for the New Orleans Times-Picayune and author of the forthcoming One Dead in Attic, available at chrisrosebooks.com in a couple of weeks. The plug is out of the way already, Chris.
Thank you very much.
My pleasure.
I guess I can leave now?
You can leave. Your car is waiting. Your car is revving. Clancy Dubos, owner, editor, co-owner, editor, and political columnist for Gambit Weekly. And T. Adelaide Martin, restaurateur, Commander's Palace, and Cafe Adelaide here in New Orleans. Three people that I know who are, as I say, passionate, committed, and informed on the subject of this city. Welcome you all.
Good to be here.
Thanks. Let me tee it off with what's in today's news, which is yesterday former Mayor Marc Morial delivered himself of a speech in which he said everybody from New Orleans should have the right to come back and rebuild where they are, where their house is. And this is in the face of an Urban Land Institute report which was submitted to the mayor a month and a half ago, saying New Orleans is going to be a smaller city with a smaller footprint. There are some areas that cannot and should not be rebuilt. And apparently there's a report coming to the mayor this week where a noted prominent local developer, Joe Cannizzaro, says basically the same thing, smaller footprint. What do you see as the size, the future of New Orleans, the footprint? Who can come back? Where can they build?
Well, I think everybody who wants to come back should be able to come back.
This is Clancy talking.
But it's easy, frankly, for someone like Marc Morial, for whom I have a great deal of respect and admiration, but it's easy for him, in his comfortable perch now in New York, to say, let my people return.
He is now head of the Urban League?
National Urban League.
But in New York.
The immediate past mayor of New Orleans.
Mm-hmm.
But I speak as one whose home was not flooded, and yet, so it would be with a little bit of arrogance for me or anyone else to say, you can come back and you can, or these neighborhoods should open and these shouldn't. It is a very difficult subject, but the numbers speak for themselves. We used to be a city of 630,000. We shrank to a city of about 462,000 in the year 2000. And now, by all estimates, in a year or two, we will be a city of between 250,000 and 300,000. We can certainly open up all the neighborhoods, let everybody come back, and two out of every three houses, or one out of every two houses, will be abandoned and blighted. Is that the kind of city we want?
I think it's kind of interesting to hear Morial saying that, because he's not running for office here that we know about. Now, our mayor and our council members—
Did you say running for or running from?
As the case may be.
I think it's kind of counterproductive for our current mayor and folks here to keep trumpeting the notion that we will rebuild every home in every neighborhood, because even if we did rebuild them all, there just aren't people who are going to be able to live in them. there's a great number of people that don't want to come back. They're not going to come back. So,
do you believe them when they say? I mean, it's understandable they say that. You know, in the immediate aftermath of the pain and the trauma they've been through. But you think after a year or so of eating Houston food, they still mean that?
Got me back quick.
Well, I don't know. I mean, I'm sure there's a great number won't come back. I have a lot of friends who are certainly not coming back. They're gone. They're gone for good. And I think there's a lot of folks like that. I think it's kind of counterproductive for our mayor to keep saying we're going to rebuild everywhere. I think it stands in the way of progress.
Logistically, you cannot physically or fiscally rebuild everywhere at once. You will so dilute the dollars that are available that it would take forever to get all of the neighborhoods back at one time.
I think it's ridiculous and wimpy to go around as a leader of this city, any of us or anybody, to say, everybody come back and live wherever the heck you want. I mean, that is ridiculous.
And nobody's got the courage
exactly.
to... We pay these land institutes, you know, every expert, both local and national and international, all come in, and they've basically all given the exact same prognosis on how to do this, how to make the footprint. And nobody here, from the governor to the mayor to the city council members, will embrace
right.
what they're telling us, what they're paying them to come
and every
and
other
us.
City where this has happened, and the Times-Picayune has covered this, and they, in my opinion, are the best newspaper in the United States of America right now, because you cannot wait to wake up every day and get real information every day. And the news programs have been great, too, because it's no longer just a crime report. You get real news now. It's fabulous. But wherever else this happened, whether it was Japan or the Netherlands or San Francisco, somebody came in and made hard decisions and said, I don't really care if I'm reelected. Here's the deal, folks. And we're going to have to make some decisions, you know, based on just information and reality. And it's no fun. But until somebody does that, we're just going to go along going, well, you know, everybody come back and let's be, you know, it's ridiculous.
Okay, but the elephant in this particular living room is race.
Sure.
People are all over the internet saying there is a conspiracy to bleach New Orleans, and the areas that are not going to be rebuilt in the reports that have come out so far are targeted as the Lower Ninth Ward, New Orleans East, low-lying areas, which were predominantly African American.
Well, you're forgetting Lakeview.
Exactly.
There's a very... even the ULI report.
Exclusively.
It cuts a big hole out of Lakeview and says, don't rebuild here. It's too low. Mm. I have friends in Lakeview whose homes took 9 to 11 feet of water. And that's in the part of Lakeview. Lakeview is a predominantly white, upscale, but not super upscale, upper middle class, business and professional class neighborhood.
Upscale nice.
Yes. But it's where a lot of white folks live in New Orleans, okay, in the city limits. And there are homes there that got 11 feet of water, and that is part of a footprint that the ULI has said, don't rebuild here.
Right.
Turn it into green space.
It's the housing really has to be addressed. It is the biggest issue in rebuilding. Well, it's hard to decide which of the issues is the biggest. But it's huge in our industry, the hospitality industry. There's nowhere for anybody to live. And that goes across all races. But you're right. I know how it's getting characterized, and that's a shame, and it does need to be addressed. But we also just have got to be realistic.
Well, the conspiracy notion, it's such a canard. First of all, if the idea is to bleach the African-American population out of New Orleans, did anybody inform Baton Rouge and Houston that we were doing this? Because, the political power structure is African-American. The voting power structure is African-American. So whose conspiracy is this? I'm guessing it's not George Bush, because most of our African-American population is wound up in Texas. So I'm guessing it's not him who hatched this plan.
That's a very good point.
And the
commission that hired the ULI to do the study was appointed by our African-American mayor, Ray Nagin.
And... The only support for a conspiracy theory that they did, in fact, bomb the levees to run African Americans out is that it actually ran 200,000 white people out of town, too. So failed so miserably. That way, I figure it does have FEMA's footprints all over it.
Well, you know, the question is, one of the facts about that area, the Lower Ninth Ward specifically, that I find amazing as a citizen sometime of another part of the country is among all low-income neighborhoods, it stands, I think, unique in its rate of home ownership. It's like, 60%
about that much, yes.
Owner-occupied. And so when you talk about that neighbor, you're talking about telling people you can't come back and rebuild on your own property.
That's correct.
Right.
And that's part of what makes it a really tough decision. But the same, you have an even higher percentage of homeownership in Lakeview.
And what about
in
Chalmette?
The area where they're telling people you can't rebuild. And then, yeah,
Chalmette,
half a mile away from the Lower Ninth Ward, going in the same direction, which is east, you have St. Bernard Parish, mm-hmm. you know, or we call them parishes, not counties, but St. Bernard Parish, which is overwhelmingly white, which had more water, and there was virtually not a dry square inch in St. Bernard Parish.
They had some Earl.
They had all kind of spilled oil from Murphy Refinery. So they not only had lots and lots of water, I mean like 15 to 20 feet in places.
But they didn't have Anderson Cooper.
God bless them.
No, I'm saying. There were
lots
cameras.
Of silver linings.
Yeah,
St. Bernard was actually the overlooked, not by the Times-Picayune and not by my paper, but by the national media. St. Bernard was the overlooked stepchild. Mm-hmm. They had the worst devastation. The entire parish was wiped out.
This was an equal opportunity
and
disaster.
A high percentage of homeownership, and a lot of those people have already chosen not to come back. And maybe that's the difference. They chose.
Yeah. So, you see suggestions that what's really going to happen eventually is that some mechanism is going to be put in place where market forces are going to sort of nudge people in the direction of, I guess I can't go back there because you can't buy insurance because there will be flood maps issued by the federal government saying this is a floodplain and this is going to flood again. And so insurance companies won't insure you and mortgage companies won't lend to you and the decision will be made that way.
It won't be quite market. It'll be sort of a government-regulated market in that FEMA will issue the flood maps. That's step one. The Picayune this morning had a great article, very long, very in-depth, and very detailed, that FEMA will issue these flood maps and that will then start the domino effect. But ultimately, it will become a financial decision because there will be no insurance market. People will not be able to afford to raise their house and rebuild because it will cost a lot more. And you're right, that could well be what ultimately happens. So because nobody has, as T mentioned, the guts to stand up and say, look, this is not a wise move to try to rebuild here, but we have other parts of town that are going to be rebuilt and they're higher and they have great housing stock and we'll help you move from that neighborhood to this neighborhood so we can all be kind of closer to each other and in the, quote, new footprint. We're just going to let those market forces. It's going to take longer to get to the same result.
I just don't understand why everybody doesn't want to live closer to the Whole Foods anyway, why they just don't want to compact everybody towards uptown.
Well, let
I
me
want the old Whole Foods.
Yeah, me too. Me too. Let's get that back while we're
at
it.
The Ninth Ward, it's 25-minute drive to Whole Foods.
Let me conclude this segment by asking a less policy-driven question, but just a question about the New Orleans that we've known and loved. Is a more compact city, a city where people are living closer together, inevitably going to mean the end of a city of shotguns, and that's a form of house here, as well as anything else, and cottages, and a city more of town homes, pardon the expression.
Oh, God, I hope not.
I don't think so, because a lot of the area in Central City, which is relatively high, has the same architecture. In fact, it's older, more historic.
No, but I mean, if you're going to bring more people in, you got to put.
No, you had a lot of vacant units there.
Oh, okay.
You need more density, is what you're saying.
Yeah.
But a lot of the plans that I've seen are using kind of the best of old architecture, and not only old architecture though, and trying to do new things to update it to today, which is exciting to me. I don't think a lot of people in this town are going to let it just go boom, be a row of townhomes like you're in Houston. I don't see that happening, and let's hope not.
Mm-hmm. Chris?
There's a lot of really good housing stock in the city. Forgive me, Chris. Go ahead.
Yeah, I don't know if the idea for shrinking the footprint is to move folks into available housing that's already there. All through Mid-City and Gentilly is the classic old New Orleans architecture, and I don't even really know the name of it, but the Creole cottages, the shotgun houses, there are still 20, I mean, hundreds of thousands of those left. I'm not sure whether the idea is to rebuild new residences for the people where they won't rebuild or to try to relocate into areas where the houses exist. They need work. They all took water, but it's still there.
Good jobs for roofers. Chris, Clancy, T, stand by. We'll continue this conversation, but first, ladies and gentlemen, a copyrighted feature of this broadcast. The Apologies of the Week.
We're so sorry.
Some good ones this week, ladies and gentlemen. An uncharacteristically humble Governor Arnold Schwarzenegger of California apologized to the voters of the state Thursday night, proposing a series of policies that represent a dramatic return to the political center after his ill-fated lurch to the right last year. "It's true I was in too much of a hurry, and I've learned my lesson," Schwarzenegger said in an address from the Assembly Chamber broadcast statewide. "I didn't hear the majority of Californians when they were telling me they didn't like..." I'm not going to do his accent. "When they told me they didn't like the special election. I barreled ahead anyway when I should have listened. To my fellow Californians, I say, quote, message received." Unquote, Arnold Schwarzenegger. In almost half of USA Today's editions on Wednesday, USA Today said in an editor's note, it was reported that 12 of the 13 trapped West Virginia miners had been found alive. The erroneous report was based on an Associated Press story citing an interview with West Virginia Governor Joe Manchin. The documentation proved inadequate and fell short of USA Today's, I'll read it correctly now, professional standards. USA Today regrets the errors. In a heavily scripted court appearance, Jack Abramoff agreed with U.S. District Judge Ellen Huvel when she said he had engaged in a conspiracy involving, quote, corruption of public officials. Quote, "Words will never be able to express my sorrow and my profound regret for all my actions and mistakes," Abramoff said to the judge. "I hope I can merit forgiveness from the Almighty and those I've wronged or caused to suffer." He's agreed to make an estimated $25 million in restitution to his victims, including an Indian tribe here in Louisiana. Walmart apologized this week after its retail website directed potential buyers of Charlie and the Chocolate Factory and Planet of the Apes DVDs to also consider purchasing DVDs with African-American themes. The world's largest retailer said in a statement that it was, quote, heartsick, meaning Walmart has a heart that can get sick, over the racially offensive grouping, and that the site was linking, quote, seemingly random combinations of titles, unquote. Says Mona Williams, vice president of corporate communications for Walmart, quote, "It's just simply not working correctly," unquote. Company said it was alerted to the problem after word began spreading among bloggers. Those damn bloggers. Norway's finance minister, Kristin Halvorsen, publicly apologized for her earlier call on citizens to boycott Israeli products. The call drew fierce criticism from Israel. Wow, imagine that. Halvorsen's call was made in her capacity as party leader of one of two parties which formed the government together with the Labour Party. "It has never been and never will be the position of the Norwegian government to advocate any such policy towards Israel," says Foreign Minister Jonas Gahr Støre. In other international apologies, Canadian Liberal leader Paul Martin has apologized for the head tax policy that charged immigrants up to $500 to enter Canada. "Do I regret this? Yes. Do I apologize? Yes." He also told a newspaper he felt deep sorrow about the issue. It was a Chinese newspaper. It's mainly Chinese immigrants that are paying the money. Imagine paying money to get into Canada. You must be desperate. A Baton Rouge, Louisiana car dealer who tried to bribe a federal court clerk for documents detailing a secret grand jury investigation into his drug business will spend more than 7 years behind bars. Former Superior pre-owned auto sales owner Rodney C. Vincent was sentenced to 87 months in federal prison. The judge called his attempt to bribe a federal court clerk a very serious offense. Vincent apologized for his crimes and his sins and said, "He is ashamed of the person I was before I came to jail. My words are very sincere. I will never buy, sell, or be involved with drugs as long as I live. I'll take jail over hell any day," unquote. And Dateline Istanbul, officials in Turkey apparently did not report the bird flu outbreak there. In the village of, I'm not going to pronounce the name of this village, last month, despite indications that birds in the vicinity had contracted the disease. Prime Minister Recep Tayyip Erdogan defended the government's response. Well, you always defend your government's response. But his justice minister, who also serves as spokesman for the ruling party, Friday apologized for having denied that bird flu had infected a human and for questioning the motives of those issuing the report. "If my statement was not satisfactory," said the justice minister, "I apologize. If there was any imprudence, I apologize. I apologize to my nation." That's an if apology, ladies and gentlemen. It gets only half credit, but it's the apologies of the week. And it is a copyrighted feature of this broadcast. Our guests sitting in Studio A, Clancy Dubose, editor and chief political columnist of the Gambit Weekly, Chris Rose, columnist for the New Orleans Times-Picayune. It's more than one time at the Picayune. And restaurateur T. Adelaide Martin are back in session. And I want to ask you three just sort of an overall question that might inform people around the country who get this stream of largely inaccurate news about New Orleans. What, in your estimations, and we'll start with T and work around to Chris and then Clancy, what's the best thing that's what are the best things that are going on in New Orleans right now, and what are the worst things?
The single best thing is that the weirdos are returning, which was a huge fear of mine.
The gutter punks?
Well, they're there, yeah. You know. But really, at first, everybody looked alike, and they looked like they were from Texas with cowboy boots and but not our people. But they're returning, people who make this city great. Just walking around the corner here today, you know, just a charming older black gentleman with a hat and on his bike and, you know, just a character. So they're coming back. But seriously, I think the best thing happening in New Orleans now is citizen leadership, that there has not been enough agreement among the political leaders. And honestly, I mean, everybody's in some kind of post-traumatic stress disorder, I think, and so you can put it off to that. But we have not had enough leadership. So finally, the citizens have just stood up and coalesced around the most important issues. I mean, these gals got together and the business council and everybody said, you know what, levies are the most important thing. We've got to fix the levies. No businesses are coming back, et cetera, et cetera. Nobody wants to live here until we do it. And they set out to get 10,000 signatures and got 50,000 in like less than a month. And that issue has really moved forward. Now they're moving on. People are coalescing around the other most important issues. So, and great things have happened in education, et cetera. The citizen leadership has been amazing, and I hope it never stops. And I hope when we look back 5 or 10 years from now, we will say that is the amazing thing that happened here in this city. Maybe we'll do 9 of 10 things right. You know, maybe we'll get it right when it comes to where the housing stock should be and how to be fair about providing that to the different diverse groups in the city. But people who would have never spent any time going to meetings and gathering and doing – they're doing it. And it's working. And, you know, the old definition of a politician is a band leader who sees which way the band's going and gets in front. Well, now the politicians are seeing which way the citizens are going, and they're coming around to some of what absolutely has to happen. So that, to me, is a glorious, rather new development in New Orleans.
I went on the subject of that. I went to the meeting on Thursday of that organization led by those Uptown Ladies, and I've been to a lot of civic meetings, unfortunately, in my life, and I must say this was the most well organized, focused. Right. Clear blessed with great brevity civic meeting I've ever attended. It was 4 speakers, including Mr. Dubose.
All right. A
lot of questions from the audience, not a single one off topic, not a single crazy tangent leading, you know, we have to spend 40 precious minutes wrestling this tangent to the floor before we can get back to the subject. None of those kind of questions, and you were out in 1 hour and 5 minutes ready to do your business. I was very impressed with that. What's the worst things? What are the worst things that are going on here now? T.
Well, that the opposite of that. You know, the lack of cohesion with the leadership is very disappointing. Whether it's, you know, trying to get together in Washington, what we need to do, or locally. And I know and like a lot of these folks, and I think some of that is coming around. I really do. And I know Mary Landrieu, for instance, is working very hard on the oil and gas royalties things, as are Jindal and Vitter and whatnot. So I think a lot of that is coming around, but that has been the worst thing.
The oil and gas royalties thing, explain that issue a little bit.
Sorry. Long story short, you know, 1/3 of the oil that goes to the United States comes through Louisiana. And we do not get the amount of oil royalties off of that oil and gas that other states do, like Texas. So if we got the same percentage as they do, we wouldn't have to ask the government for money all the time to fix the levees, restore the wetlands. We could take care of ourselves permanently. And it's just the way these things came down over the years is the deals 60 years ago with local politicians. I mean, it's really unfair. We are not looking for a handout. We're looking for a fair shake. And so people are coalescing around these issues so Louisiana can take care of itself with its own money.
Let me add one other historical or even current footnote to that. If you drill a well on federal lands in, say, Wyoming, Wyoming gets 50% of the royalties. If you drill in federal waters off the coast of Louisiana, Louisiana gets almost nothing, in some cases nothing. And it's a fairness question. If the same well drilled off the coast of Texas brings royalties to Texas and in Mississippi and in Alabama, Louisiana is alone among the Gulf states that gets either nothing or close to nothing from federal offshore drilling.
Okay, Chris, the best things are going on here and the worst.
The best thing going on in New Orleans, I think, right now is the display of the triumph of the individual human spirit as manifested through creative cultural expression. In English, what I mean is that New Orleans sounds and smells like New Orleans again. Almost all of the significant music clubs are up and operating. Almost all of the significant restaurants in town are up and running again, and they're packed every night. The community here is supporting it en masse. One reason for that is a lot of people have to go to restaurants because they don't have gas service, they don't have refrigerators, things like that.
It's a conspiracy by the restaurant industry.
Absolutely.
There you go. And the people are going to the music clubs because if you live in this town right now, the notion of watching a rerun of Will and Grace on television is just such a mind-boggling notion. If you listen to David Letterman's monologue at night, it's a disconnect. We're having trouble keeping up with pop culture and what's going on everywhere else. But the music is back very strong and getting stronger every day. The restaurants are here and cooking. And we do this not for the tourism trade. We do this because we like it and we support it. But what is so significant about this is what everybody else likes to come here to do. And that element is here for now people to come and enjoy. People say we shouldn't try to base our economy on tourism, but I'm pretty sure that's what we've done for the last 50 years. So the best thing is that we are beginning to feel like New Orleans again in the areas that are open and dry.
The island, as it's called.
On the island, Bermuda. Isn't it the same size as Bermuda? It's 6 miles long, 1 mile
right?
wide, just doesn't have the good golf courses.
And the worst things are going on right now.
I think for me, I see it is mostly anxiety about two things. I think one is the human element. I think what lies ahead of us are a series of slow, small rippling effects of foreclosures, bankruptcies, broken marriages, a sort of ripple effect of despondency through the community that I somewhat fear and has manifested itself already. Our suicide rate is a little off the charts right now. And actually, my biggest fear of all is the FEMA trailer parks, which is an extremely hot-button topic here.
Mm.
My biggest problem with them is if you go look at them, they look like prisons. They're fenced in. The trailers are all piled up one on top of each other. It looks like a recipe for desolate living conditions. And I don't know whose idea it was to pave over every playground in the city of New Orleans and put the trailer parks there, thereby giving the children the only place for them to go is now in the streets that are filled with garbage and wreckage and sheetrock and abandoned vehicles. I'm not sure whose idea that was, but I don't really think it was a good one. It seems to me that the trailer park should be surrounding the playgrounds. But anyway, my big fear is what happens when we start moving people into these they're ghettos. They're ghettos. They put up fences around them and paved it all in, and it doesn't look good. I wouldn't want to live there.
Clancy, same question.
Last night, Harry, you and I were out in the Warehouse Arts District, mm-hmm. and I think that, to me, is typical of what Chris and T both talked about, the city coming back to life. The first Saturday of every month in New Orleans, in the evening, the art galleries downtown in the Warehouse Arts District have their new shows, and literally thousands of people turn out and just roam from gallery to gallery, drinking bad wine, and admiring the art. And then we go out to eat at Emeril's and Tommy's and lots of other wonderful places. And last night, I had to wait an hour and a half to get a table, and I was thanking God for every minute of it, because we were back. And that's a really important cultural practice, if you will. It's an institution, really, going out to the galleries once a month. The clubs are open, the restaurants. We had some of our fabulous restaurants open just this past week, and more of them are going to reopen. Little mom-and-pop businesses are reopening, not just the big ones. And I think that really speaks volumes about the resiliency, and as Chris called it, the triumph of the human spirit. People in New Orleans, we've been through, I heard somebody give a statistic, 27 epidemics in our history or something
like that. Yellow fever and over malaria.
Over and over again. This is just one more. We'll deal with it. This is the one that's been televised around the world, but we've had more than two dozen prior to this. We've come back before. We're going to come back from this. I see us coming back, and I think that's just wonderful.
Okay, and the worst things are going on right now?
I agree with what T and Chris said. The disconnect between leadership and our political so-called leaders, they're squabbling. Nobody's having the guts to stand up and say, this is what we need to do. Make a decision, even if it's wrong. Make a doggone decision, and let's rally around it. And that is having a really bad socioeconomic effect on New Orleans, because it's their indecision is causing this simmering race and class issue to boil. And they need to just make the decision and we'll all deal with it, and then they can run for re-election, either win or lose. I think one reason why they're so afraid is because our elections have been delayed. They were supposed to be February 4th with a runoff on March 4th. They're now going to be, we think, in April. And so the citywide, the mayor and the city council are trying to just hold their breath and whistle past the graveyard and hope they get past the elections and then make a decision.
Isn't it interesting how phrases that have been metaphorical for all of our lives now suddenly have a literal meaning, like whistle past the graveyard?
Yes.
And I was going to say, in introducing you, Clancy, that this man's such an expert on Louisiana politics, he knows where all the bodies are buried, and then I thought better of it. There's a delegation going over to the Netherlands now, led by Senator Mary Landrieu, taking business leaders and political officials. This is mid-January. Anybody who cared about this issue knew about the Netherlands in October. Is this the time lag that's typical of what's going on here, that it took them until January to organize a trip to the Netherlands?
Yes.
Okay, good.
It is typical.
Short answer.
Yeah, good.
I don't know. I think people even before the storm thought we should have hash bars in the French Quarter. Why we're just deciding to emulate?
I go Dutch every night, man. I don't know about you.
The Dutch culture now.
Yeah. Let me ask one other.
Oh, I'm sorry. What's that? Oh, we're talking about levies.
Yeah.
Oh, sorry.
I have one other question that I think is on a lot of people's minds outside New Orleans that we should tackle in this segment. Health. Is it healthy to be here? People ask me that all the time.
No. Next question.
I mean physically.
Chris, everybody listening to this across the country does not know that you're nuts and that you're being silly. It's fine to be here,
right,
health-wise.
It is fine to be here.
Yes.
They do. They still ask about the water and the whatever. Mm-hmm. The water is apparently fine, but doesn't taste as good as it used to. But anyway, it's fine to be here. If you hang out with the mold and, ripping out sheetrock, you get the Katrina crud. But otherwise, it's absolutely fine.
The air smells a lot better now than it did in early October.
A gorgeous, gorgeous day. But, Harry, can I ask you a question?
Yeah.
Would you repeat what you were saying to me the other night when we were having a little cocktail, that there is a double message that New Orleans has to give about, you know what I'm talking about?
Oh, you mean...
About itself.
Yeah, you mean...
That we're here, and we're back, and you can come, and there's great fun things to do, and it's gorgeous here today.
And then there's still a lot of devastation, and both things are true.
Exactly.
And most news stories aren't able to cover more than even one half of that,
Yeah.
I think that's the big button on the Mardi Gras issue.
Right.
We want to have Mardi Gras. We want to embrace our traditions, embrace our history, announce to the world that we are still here, we're alive. And we want to embrace our cultural touchstone. And I guess everybody's worried that, you know, Anderson Cooper and everyone else are going to say, hey, look, they're fighting over plastic beads in the streets and flashing in the
Mission
streets
accomplished.
Of the French Quarter.
Mission accomplished.
But it's a necessary evil. We do have to send two messages. On one hand, we do have to be on our knees before Congress and corporations and anyone else who can help us to say we're beat up. I think, you know, maybe even going back to the first segment on the show, I'm not sure, just to let the listeners know, I don't think you announced the statistic. Am I correct? 80% of our housing stock is destroyed.
Adversely affected.
Or profoundly affected to the point where you cannot live there. And I think you were speaking about our population. Before the storm, we probably had 460,000 people sleeping here on a typical night. Prior to Christmas holidays, we had about 60,000. I think that's probably doubled over the holidays as schools are reopening this month. We had a big influx of people, but we're still missing 75% of our homes and probably 60 to 75% of our people, which is a profound notion. If anybody looked out the window of their town right now and looked up and down the street and thought, if 75% of it all went away. Now, a lot of people might like that idea.
Which gets back to their
in their communities.
Topic.
But the indiscriminate devastation here is mind-boggling. We do need people to know that. But we do need to let them know that we're here. We're not rolling over.
Let me talk about Mardi Gras a little bit, because I was thinking about this. I will give a disclaimer. I'm on the board of the Convention and Visitors Bureau. I'm not in the hospitality industry, but I do sit on that on the CVB board. And there are CVBs all over the country that do the same thing that we do. We promote the idea that you should come to our town and visit, enjoy yourself, and spend a lot of money. I think the message that we send with Mardi Gras has to be very carefully articulated. And that is that we are a city that has endured hardship throughout our history. That's why we have Mardi Gras. Mardi Gras is not just an orgy or a drunk. It is actually a celebration of life. It has its roots in paganism as well as Christianity. It is a celebration of life over death. And you can attach as little or as much spiritual significance to that as you want. But it is a statement about the human spirit and the New Orleans spirit. And now more than ever, I think it is very important for New Orleans to celebrate life, to celebrate its life. And yes, the devastation is all around us. It was here today. It's going to be there for a few more months. But in the meantime, we're going to celebrate the fact that at least those of us who are here, and we're alive, and we're not giving up. That's the message of this year's Mardi Gras.
All right. I want to get more into cultural matters and if you will, the soul, the future of the soul of New Orleans. T. Martin, Clancy Dubose, and Chris Rose, take a break, get some Diet Coke into you, and we'll continue the broadcast with another copyrighted feature. News from outside the bubble. Not quite outside the bubble, but just as good as if you're watching TV. A report by Congress's research arm concluded this week that the administration's justification for warrantless eavesdropping conflicts with existing law and hinges on weak legal arguments. That's the Congressional Research Service's report, rebutting the central assertions made by Bush and his attorney general about the president's authority to conduct warrantless wiretaps. But even more interestingly, when President Bush signed the bill outlawing the torture of detainees, ladies and gentlemen, he quietly reserved the right to bypass the law, the law that he was signing under his powers as commander-in-chief. After approving the bill, Bush issued a signing statement, an official document in which a president lays out his interpretation of a law, declaring that he'll view the interrogation limits in the context of his broader powers to protect national security. This means Bush believes he can waive the restrictions, the White House and legal specialists said. Three Republican senators condemned that assertion. John Warner, a Republican who chairs the Armed Services Committee, Senator John McCain, issued a joint statement rejecting the assertion that he can waive the restrictions on cruel, inhuman, and degrading treatment against detainees. The White House did not return calls asking about the senators' opposition to the signing statement, which, I don't know, me, sounds like the kind of policy, you know, I'll go along with this, but I'll issue a clarification saying that I won't. It just sounds like a policy that we can all adopt in troublesome areas of our lives, don't you think? This is Le Show from New Orleans. And some good news, ladies and gentlemen. The real cost of the United States of the war in Iraq is likely to be between $1 trillion and $2 trillion, up to 10 times more than previously thought. That's according to a report written by a Nobel Prize-winning economist and a Harvard budget expert. That's Harvard. The study expanded on traditional estimates by including such costs as lifetime disability and health care for troops injured in the conflict, impact on the American economy, concluding the U.S. government is continuing to underestimate the cause of the war. The cost of the war, excuse me. The report is likely to add pressure on the White House on the war. This is in the British newspaper, The Guardian. Of course, it's appeared on all of our media in this country because it's important. Our guests, T. Adelaide Martin, restaurateur, Commander's Palace, Cafe Adelaide, Clancy Dubose, owner, editor, political columnist of the Gambit Weekly in New Orleans, and Chris Rose, columnist for the New Orleans Times-Picayune. It seems to me that it's almost inevitable in a period like this that New Orleans is a place. It's exciting. It's not dangerous in the sense of the crime that we had before, but it's, you know, you drive down the streets and there's still an awful lot of debris, an awful lot of stuff you have to avoid. There are a lot of potholes. There are wires dangling down in certain areas that you have to. It's a challenging urban environment. Let's put it that way. And it seems to me that the city might be attracting, in addition to those who are coming home, a certain group of folks who want to come into a challenging and opportunity-filled urban environment, young urban pioneers. Is there a danger that we're going to have a population in 2 or 3 years that doesn't know how things are done in New Orleans? You know what I mean? One of the things I love about this city is the sense that there is a meaning to almost every day here, and there's a way things are done, not just in terms of politics. Hopefully that's changing. But can you change that and retain this sense of here's how we do things in this city that's different from every other city in the country? Anybody want to grapple with that?
That sounds like a Chris question.
All right. Chris, it's your question.
I'm not sure exactly what you mean on a couple points. I mean, I don't know what the influx of people is going to be into this town, but I can tell you right now, they're going to need money, because one of our biggest problems is there's no affordable housing stock here. You would think that this environment might attract poets and artists and musicians who might want to come be a part of certainly what stands to be the most exciting and challenging urban revitalization project in
urban what? Urban what?
I don't know. What did I say?
Revitalization. Yeah.
Rebuilding. Mm-hmm. Rebuilding. As for people coming in, you need a lot of money right now. Rents have gone up. There's not a lot of places to live. As far as changing ways, I don't know. I think we're almost impervious to change and have proven so for a long time. I think any restaurant that ever tried to feature red beans and rice as their lunch special on Tuesday instead of Monday was out of business within 6 weeks.
If it took that long. And to tag on to what Chris just said, I think the type of, quote, new people who come here will be coming here looking for what New Orleans has traditionally offered. They will want to become part of how we do things, and they will learn it. They will contribute to it. It's resistant to change, but it does evolve over time. With each successive wave of immigrants that we've had here, whether it's the Irish, the Italians, Africans, Caribbeans, whoever, Mediterraneans, there is a way of doing things here, and I don't think it will change. I think the type of new folks who come, maybe I'm being naive, but I think the urban pioneers will want to come here because they're attracted to at least the idea of New Orleans, and when they get here, they'll get a dose of the reality, and they'll either stay and adapt, or they'll leave, which is what has happened for eons. Right.
That's it. The understanding, Harry, is that we change you. You can't change us. even for the better.
So it shall be.
The city is like a character in your life, you know, unlike other cities where you could live in Kansas or Houston. I mean, I don't mean to criticize any city. We have a wonderful business, and never has one city been better to another city than Houston was to New Orleans, I feel,
yes,
during this.
And Baton Rouge and Lake Charles, people have...
Amazing.
Stepped up. Lafayette,
but people don't feel about those cities the way people who live here and want to live here, and like you, Harry, come and then decide you just have to have a home here, you know, feel about it. The city itself is like another member of your family. And I've always felt that, you know, people talk about, well, why is New Orleans so unique in the food, the architecture, the music, of course. But it is really a way of life, a way of thinking about life, in that I think the thing that we've been kind of ahead of the rest of the country on is that we understand that life is meant to be lived. You're not just here existing. You are meant to enjoy this life, and New Orleanians do that more than most people day in and day out, I feel like. And so if you come from some, you know, overly hardworking place and come here, we'll fix that in you right away.
Well, I guess I'm asking because, you know, part of what we're seeing now, certainly from the national government, such as it is a call for a change in the political culture of this state and this city. You know, and certainly a lot of people, the Uptown Ladies that are leading that movement we were talking about earlier, T, mm-hmm. I heard words get applause at that meeting on Thursday that I never would have dreamed would have gotten applause in New Orleans. Words like transparency in government, you know. Can you change one part of the culture without changing the rest of the culture? Will New Orleans inevitably become more American as this thing plays out?
Let me talk to the political aspect of it, Harry. I've always bristled when people say, oh, you know, you can't really change it because it's part of our culture. Baloney. You know, gumbo is still going to be made the same way if we have honesty in government.
Wait a minute. Baloney gumbo?
Well, okay, maybe not. Baloney, period, pause.
Gumbo.
Our gumbo.
It's big in Milwaukee.
T's not going to change any of her recipes if she can go down to City Hall and get the permit in one stop to open up, as opposed to, you know, having to host a fundraiser for some city council member or whatever. You know, it's, you know, we got to separate the political culture from the real culture. So my take is, you know, we're going to be a city with a great soul and a great sound and a great smell and all the great things about it, and we can have honest government. And I do think that's changing. By the way, the committee that we all keep talking about is called the Committee for One Greater New Orleans, and their focus has been getting one levy board for all of Southeast Louisiana, as opposed to each parish or sub-parish having its own levy district and balkanizing the whole regional need for flood protection. And they are very focused. And my talk that I gave to them was, don't stop at the levees. Go fix everything else once you do that. And I think there is a real, it gets back to what T said earlier, there's a real activism, a sense of newfound civic activism among people in New Orleans taking control of things and leading, then having the politicians follow. I think our political culture can change. I think the seeds of change are there right now. I think the city elections will go part of the way towards that, but it's a process that needs to go on for maybe 10 or 20 years.
I used to say New Orleans is probably the only city in the United States that would have elected head of its local cable system to dog catcher, let alone mayor. Now I think it's probably the only city in the United States that's praying for local elections. But in the moments we have left, we've been talking about levy boards, and this gets to, I think, what I still think, despite the heroic efforts of the Times-Picayune and a lot of other journalists in this town, is the great untold story of New Orleans, which is it was not a natural disaster.
Thank you.
It was a man-made disaster. And I'm interested in first why New Orleans politicians don't stand up, and Louisiana politicians don't stand up as one and say that to the federal government, you broke us, you got to fix us. And two, can you explain what responsibility either the fractionated or the united levy boards has vis-a-vis the flood walls that breached? Anybody wants to tackle that?
Well, first of all, it needs to be repeated. This was not a natural disaster. It was a man-made disaster. It was made by Congress and the Army Corps of Engineers. Congress, by not appropriating enough money, and the Corps of Engineers by their defective design and construction of the flood walls. They've taken after our local levee boards, and look, I've done it. It's not even very sporting. It's like fish in a barrel. But let me say this.
They're good eating those barrel fish.
One flood wall that did not breach is the flood wall along a street called Marconi. There's a drainage canal there called the Orleans Outfall Canal. It's one of three or four major drainage canals that go from the heart of the city northward into Lake Pontchartrain. That flood wall was designed and built by the Orleans Levee Board with what's called a T-wall. The Orleans Levee Board's engineer was fired because he told the Corps you shouldn't put an I-wall, ironically named I-wall, for the flood walls along the 17th Street Canal and the London Avenue Canal.
Which are supposedly less robust, right?
They are less, well, they're certainly
strong.
Not as strong.
Yeah.
And they fired him, and the I-walls designed and built by the Corps of Engineers broke, and the T-wall designed and built by the levee board's former engineer held.
In other words, the locally engineered ones held, and the ones that the federal government is responsible for. We made it through the hurricane just fine. It was
right.
then the levees broke. the ones maintained by
actually,
the federal government.
The levees didn't break.
Right.
The flood walls
broke.
Exactly.
That's another key point. The earthen levees, which is what we really need, held. The water did not go over the levees in most of the city. It went over the levees in the far eastern part of New Orleans, thanks to another U.S. Army Corps of Engineers project.
Mr. Go.
Mississippi River Gulf Outlet, a.k.a. Mr. Go.
Why has it been so difficult to get that message out to the nation as a whole?
The message has gotten out. It just hasn't been listened to by Congress.
You think people outside New Orleans understand that this was a man-made disaster?
No, they do not.
Well, I think that, and also the magnitude of the disaster. I think a lot of people, and here, I think there's a delusional sense here in New Orleans that we took the hit and we're going to be fine. Look, the Garden District made it, the French Quarter make it, we took the hit. Well, we didn't take the hit. This was a Category 3 storm that made landfall in Mississippi. I'm not sure a lot of people realize.
Mississippi took the hit.
We didn't take anything close to the hit. And this storm was north of Jackson, Mississippi, when people started dying here. Mm. You know, that being the man-made portion there. The storm didn't kill anyone in New Orleans, unless they were standing on a rooftop and got knocked off. But the fatalities began racking up when that storm was way up in Mississippi.
Okay, just as we're closing, I don't think I can recall one instance, even when the mayor and the governor both went up to Washington to testify, where any locally or state elected official just stood up and said, "You broke us, you got to fix us. This is not a pity date. This is for real. You owe us."
We sure wish they would do that, and I like the way you phrase it, Harry. But the country, they don't get it, and they don't really understand the magnitude of it. They do not.
They don't want to get it because then it means they got to put up a big check to fix this, and Congress doesn't want to do that. And not to defend our politicians, but I think Governor Blanco and Mayor Nagin tried to get that message out, but when they got there, it was a congressional hearing for all these congressmen and senators in other parts of the country to get on their soapboxes and point their fingers at us and say, "Why didn't you evacuate faster?" Well, you know what? The evacuation would have been totally unnecessary if the federally designed flood walls had held. It didn't matter. We could have all stayed home except for far eastern New Orleans and St. Bernard Parish if they had just built the doggone flood walls correctly.
Chris, any closing thoughts on this?
Well, after all this, gosh.
It doesn't have to be on this. Just closing thoughts, because we're almost out of time.
Closing thoughts. You know, anyone who's listening, save up some money. Come visit us. Come down here. Tip generously. Take public transportation.
Read the paper.
You know,
buy all the papers.
There's my closing thought. Can I do this real quick?
Yeah.
The media has, you know, I'm going to give the salutations to the media, even though two of us in here are part of the room. I think we've carried the day. I think it's strange times in this city that the media, who people like to pick on, are the only voices of reason that are resonating through this community while our political leaders flounder. It is interesting times here. NOLA.com, which is the Times-Picayune's website, in the 10 days after the storm was averaging 30 million hits a day for people getting information. And that's more than Jenna Jameson gets. You know, when a newspaper website's getting more than porn, then the world has turned upside down.
A good thought to end on. Chris Rose, author of One Dead in Attic, available at chrisrosebooks.com very soon. Clancy Dubose of the Gambit Weekly. And T. Adelaide Martin of Commander's Palace and Cafe Adelaide. Thank you all for sharing your thoughts and your passion for this great city.
Thank you.
Thanks, Harry.
That concludes this week's edition of Le Show. The program returns next week at the same time over these same stations. The show comes to you from New Orleans, Louisiana today, and my thanks to Bob Dunn, a tip of the Le Show chapeau to the San Diego and Pittsburgh desks. The show playlists, when we play lists, available at harryshearer.com. The show comes to you from Century of Progress Productions and originates through the facilities of KCRW Santa Monica, a community recognized around the world as the home of the homeless. So long from New Orleans.